This is Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria and Bahrain. I've been following the Ukraine episode with intense interest because to me it's so reminiscent of Syria. So many echoes of Syria, but not in the way that the elite, the MSM, the powers that be are telling us. They're talking about Russia taking pages out of the Russian playbook that was used in Syria. That's just misleading. There is a playbook being used in Ukraine that was also used in Syria, and it's not Russia's, it's America's and Britain's. A small example that just came to hand earlier today with reports that Russia has been removing rescue workers from humanitarian convoys in Ukraine. Immediately, I had a sense of déjà vu. This is the white helmets phenomenon. You may recall that in Syria, the rescue workers called themselves the White Helmets, and they were in fact trainees largely of the British government, which financed them, provided them with the equipment they used, the equipment mainly being cameras, not rescue equipment, but helmet-borne portable cameras, because they're prime purpose was to film themselves carrying out fake rescues in fake incidents for that to be presented before gullible Western publics. And the White Helmets have played a very big role in the information war in Syria. And lo and behold, their opposite numbers in Ukraine have just made their debut performance. These individuals, very likely, describing themselves as rescue workers, very likely some, if not all of them, are in fact members of the Azov battalion or one of the other neo-Nazi groups which infest Mariupol. So what's going on here is denazification, as the Russians said was going to happen. So this is just one small example of what the Ukraine performance has looked like to me, a replay of Syria with all the fakery involved and the manipulation of Western audiences with tales of atrocities and what have you.
Now, the trouble is that the situation in Ukraine, we've had this narrative from Russia, which of course is actually quite difficult to get now in the West here. But they basically say that that this was a threat to Russia, that they might join NATO. But if you look up into the Baltics, Peter, you'll find a country called Latvia, which is just about the same distance from Moscow, which is already part of NATO. So it doesn't really wash, does it, this idea that that the Russians can't stand Ukraine being so close to Moscow, because the NATO is already that close.
I take the point, Tony, at first bat. It does seem a bit odd, but there are major differences between the two cases. First of all, Latvia, the case is done and dusted. Russia didn't, at the time Latvia became a member of NATO, feel quite as threatened as it subsequently felt, as more and more, I think a total of more than 10 East European countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union joined NATO. And when Latvia joined, it wasn't clear how far the process was going to go. And secondly, Ukraine is a much bigger, much more important strategically country than little Latvia. And the history is also very different. Russia feels the same towards Ukraine. I may be stretching the comparison here, but a little bit like people in Britain felt towards Ireland. It was part of us. And therefore, when Ukraine not only left us, but was about to hook up with our hated rival, it's not surprising that Russia balked and responded. We'd reached the red line. In other words, Latvia wasn't the red line, but Ukraine was.
Yes. Also, another one of the comparisons between Ukraine and Syria is this whole idea of chemical weapons. Although we've also had the talk about biological potential, anyway, biological weapons labs in Ukraine, which one of the things that were most concerning the Russians, including, as we heard a few weeks ago from Diliana Gatasheva in Bulgaria, the idea that these labs in the United States, the Pentagon, wanted synovial material from ethnic Russians so they could try out these various pathogens on some sort of Russian tissue to see what the effect would be. Now, this is obviously going to alarm the Russians. And so what do you make of the chemical weapons connection, if there is one? Because we've heard scares anyway already, the Western media saying that there may be a chemical attack by Russia in Ukraine.
Well, to coin a phrase, this is sulfurous. This is sulfurous, dangerous talk. We saw this in Syria, where actually Russia supervised a process of de-chemicalization of Syria. Russia shepherded through with the UN an internationally supervised process of dismantling and removing outside Syria the chemical weapons that Syria did possess before 2013, or was it 2014? After that, Syria itself had no more chemical weapons, or at least in the territories controlled by the Syrian government. Now, there were a couple of sites where chemical weapons had been stored, but they were in the jihadi, the rebel-controlled areas. And who'd have guessed it? The international inspectors didn't want to go to those areas, or they thought it was too dangerous to. So there may have been some residues of chemical weapons in the rebel-held areas. And these turned up in some well-publicized incidents. And Syria, the government of Syria, got blamed. And it was all a fabrication. There was only one incident where international inspectors were able to go to the site of the alleged crime, and that was the Duma incident in 2018. Every other place where use of chemical weapons was alleged was in jihadi-controlled territory, and the inspectors were never allowed to go there, which didn't stop them, US and UK instigation, pointing the finger at Syria. But in the case of Duma, it was rather embarrassing for Britain and America, because some of the inspectors said they found evidence of fraud, of evidence tampering. A chlorine canister was found to have apparently jumped off the floor onto a bed. It was ridiculous. But these parts of the inspector's report were doctored in the eventual final report at the behest of Britain and America. So these shenanigans have been going on for the benefit of Western audiences to persuade our Western public opinion that we, the West, ought to be bombing Syria, which we did after the Douma incident, and ought to be more involved with boots on the ground, which fortunately was one step too far. But that's what's going on now in Ukraine. The parallels are so obvious to anyone who followed Syria at all closely. It's the same playbook, as they say. It's the Douma playbook all over again. I'm bracing myself for a fake incident in Ukraine, which will involve these rescue workers, these Ukrainian white helmets, now making their appearance, now being introduced to us. We become familiar with their work, and they will miraculously be on the spot when chemical weapons or bioweapons allegedly turn up in some dreadful atrocity in Ukraine. And this is Ukraine trying to drag us into the war. It's extremely, extremely dangerous because they may well succeed.
Well, if they do, then it could even be that that sort of shock moment might enable NATO to justify to their so-called political leaders, who sometimes look like they are actually their political minions, agreeing to NATO a NATO intervention in Ukraine, Peter.
Exactly, and that's precisely why it's going to be done, or I believe the Ukrainians are planning for it to be done. And the fact that the Americans are already talking about it, but they're trying to frame it, they're trying to frame Russia in advance by saying that that Russia is making these accusations to cover themselves. So it's sort of a framing within a framing. But the end result is to condition Western audiences immediately to jump to the conclusion, when the expected fake incident happens, that it must be Russia and Russia must be punished.
So what would be the outcome, do you think, if NATO did intervene directly in Ukraine?
Well, it would be potentially absolutely horrendous. It would likely have to involve, at a very minimum, NATO bombing of Russian troops in Ukraine. It might go as far as bombing sites in Russia itself. But in either case, it would call forth a Russian retaliation. The rules of the escalation game require that, otherwise Russia would be exposing itself to ever more heavy bombing. And Russia might retaliate, following their own doctrine, by using military doctrine, by going straight to tactical nuclear weapons, possibly on a target in Poland to begin with. And then that just sets the light to the blue touch paper.
Yeah, but surely it's much more likely that an intervention would be, say, for example, in the air. So an attempt to shoot down Russian aircraft, Peter.
Well, not based on the Syrian model. When Syria was accused, then the France, Britain and America bombed half a dozen sites alleged to be connected to chemical weapons operations in Syria, a research center and military sites that were alleged to be where chemical weapons were being held or prepared. So I think that would be the model that would probably be followed. The punishment, you see, would need to appear to fit the crime.
Yeah, so there are various estimates as to how long this Russian operation is going to take, and even what the actual objective is. It may be, you know, one of the likely scenarios is that the Russians will attempt to bring eastern Ukraine under control and leave the west of Ukraine for the post 2014. Government to the Azov battalion, the Nazis in Lviv, and that could take roughly, well, we don't know, but it may take several months. So do you think that's where things are going? And I suppose if this incident that you project may happen, we have a tense few months before us. When do you think this situation? When do you think the Russians will complete their what they call special military operation, this invasion of Ukraine?
That's very hard for anyone, not just the diplomat, but also for military experts, including, I suspect, the Russians themselves. The whole thing is probably taking longer than they originally calculated. But the trajectory that we're on, it will take 2 or 3 months for Russia to complete enough operations for it to be satisfied that its mission accomplished. 2 or 3 months, I would say, after which there might be a period of consolidation, negotiations, which could take another couple of months. And during that time, an incident could be staged at any point. It would hinge on when the Ukrainians felt that their backs were really against the wall, and that the target audience, the Western audience, had been sufficiently primed and was ready.
Well, there's also some saying that, that this will never be over in Ukraine, that there will always be military action between what would be a Western-controlled West Ukraine and a Russian-controlled Eastern Ukraine, and that potentially they may even have to have some sort of, maybe 10, 20-mile band of kind of no man's land between the two, even ending up potentially like a kind of North-South Korea situation, Peter?
That's certainly one possible scenario, Tony. I don't think it's what the Russians are aiming at. They're aiming at the demilitarization of the entirety of Ukrainian territory, and they may still achieve that objective. But the scenario you describe, dreadful as it is a realistic possibility, and the scope for misreadings and spillovers the border would be very troubling indeed. But you know, the fat lady hasn't sung yet by any means. Most of the pundits, the Western pundits, are enjoying themselves saying how Russia's failing to achieve its objectives, it's bogged down, it's not advancing, it's going terribly for the Russians, and Putin might get booted out because he's failing. This is based mostly on wishful thinking, not hard analysis. And it may just be that the Russians are playing a long game. We don't really have a handle on many of the military operations. We don't know, for example, it's never explained to us how much attrition the Ukrainian military have suffered. I suspect it's a lot higher than we're being told.
So if there is some sort of a provocation in order to get a wider war started, what should we watch out for on our TV screens, Peter?
Well, if it's anything like Syria, it will be extremely sudden. But One warning sign would be more and more reports of rescue workers. And I've just mentioned, I've just drawn attention to their debut, their public debut in this conflict, which I find rather ominous. If we hear more about the rescue workers who are going to be the people who will be the first responders when this alleged incident takes place, that will be the sign to get your visa for New Zealand.
Well, I'm afraid you're not allowed to travel to New Zealand. You won't get your visa. But nobody, surely, Peter, nobody wants a world war.
Well, nobody wanted World War One, but they stumbled into it. This is the great danger that, and this is the trajectory that we're on, of stumbling into it. Both Russia and NATO may find that they've bitten off more than they can chew and end up in a conflict neither really wanted or was prepared for.
It does show an enormous confidence in the Russians that they think that they can do this successfully. Something that we didn't see all the that time ago in 2014 when the coup first happened. What do you think has given that Russia such confidence?
8 years of preparation time. I think they drew their conclusions after the 2014 operation. And concluded that they would give the West several years to see if NATO continued to expand. And when NATO did just that, the Russian red line was reached. But by that time, Russia had made many preparations. It has a war chest, an immense, immense war chest. And even though the Western powers have confiscated possibly half of that money that was held in Western central banks, many billions of dollars, still, Russia is one of the, even with that, Russia still has far higher reserves than most Western countries and can withstand a great deal of financial pressure. They've also made obvious military preparations, for example, development of hypersonic missiles. Several of these weapons were developed in the Syrian theater. So the Russians have had several years to practice and prepare. I think that this helps explain their confidence, or some would say overconfidence.
The whole Ukraine business, in a way a little bit like Brexit or COVID, seems to have completely divided people, sometimes even split families in half. So I wonder, is it just the press that's done this, or is it the situation itself? What do you think, Peter?
It is striking that the same people for and against line up against each other. Whether it's Ukraine or COVID or climate or all the other hysterias that are slopping around. And hysteria is what it is. Some people are hysterics and some are not. This is the main dividing line, I think. The same people that were hysterical about a virus, a relatively harmless virus, who are hysterical about climate emergency, are the same people who are hysterical about Russia. And in every case, they're distinguished by control freakery and virtue signaling. Have you noticed? They want to control the weather, or control the spread of a common cold variant, or they want to control Satan, that is Putin, who is demonized to excess. But in every case, they want control over something that isn't going to be controlled, the weather, virus, Russia, but they want control, and at the same time they want to feel good about it. So they pose as the moral party in each case. But when you look at the people involved, like Boris Johnson, you have to wonder whether there isn't a correlation between loose morals and Russophobia.
If you could just explain to listeners how they can find you online or follow you.
I don't blog, but I appear regularly in First Century Wire, which you can find online. Just Google First Century Wire.
Peter Forbes, former ambassador to Syria, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tony.